Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, an over-the-top spending bender, including a $5 million ring and a $2 million birthday party, led to charges of looting against two executives at Tyco International. Now complaints about the behavior of jury and media both are rocking the Tyco trial. This hour On Point, cries of a runaway jury and judging the lords of Tyco. We begin in New York, where today Judge Michael Obus rejected the defense call for a mistrial. Barney Gimbel is covering the case for Newsweek magazine. Barney, it's been a rough patch in this Tyco trial. What was the judge's reasoning today?
He basically thought that he didn't want the newspaper and the media to take over his trial. I mean, the New York Post ran, you know, a very graphic, if nothing else, a front page on Saturday that had the infamous juror number four, you know, showing an okay sign to the, you know, allegedly to the defendant's table.
This was an artist's sketch of the signal that she reportedly made in the courtroom.
Right, which none of us saw it that way, actually. Much of us, the okay sign that I saw on Friday was much, much less inflammatory, and it was could be easily also brushed as she was just brushing her hair. It was didn't look as pronounced as they did in the newspaper.
Interesting. So this could be some artistic license in addition to everything else.
Well, certainly.
They were pretty tough, though, and very public, calling her the holdout granny, the batty blue blood, publishing her name, as the Wall Street Journal did also online, and giving some facts of her life. The judge said, I'm not going to let the newspapers, flap about this?
Essentially. You know, he didn't want the newspapers to do that, and he also that's one thing aside. But also, today in the courtroom, the jurors started getting along again, and they said that they were able to deliberate and were asking very intelligent questions, asking for readbacks of particular parts of testimony, and basically even in the afternoon wrote a note to the judge when they were asking for another readback saying much water has passed under the bridge since last Thursday.
Well, so maybe that weekend off after nearly six months of trial and a week and more of deliberation has helped them out. But it was awfully bad last week. There was a note from the jury saying that talking about one juror that was a problem or the jury a problem, said we firmly believe that this jury's ability to communicate and deliberate with an open mind is irreparably compromised. There was talk of more than talk, they'd written that the atmosphere in the jury room was poisonous.
I know. It's incredible how this turned into sort of as you said, a six-month trial to going down to last Thursday when we thought we were going to have a verdict, you know, to, you know, all of a sudden it sort of erupted. It really, what we're learning is that, which is a rare glimpse into a jury room, I might add, mm-hmm. All of us sit on the side usually trying to contemplate, but here we have some real evidence of what was going on. It was, you know, infamous juror number four, it sounds like, sticking to her guns that these people were innocent. And it's unclear if the rest of the jury really believed they were necessarily guilty, but they really wanted discussion on it. And apparently she didn't want to discuss any of it. And now apparently she's back on track and they're going forward.
Barney, remind us of the basics here. The 32 counts against Kozlowski and his ex-finance chief, Mark Swartz. What are the primary counts?
The primary counts are basically about, you know, looting the company of $600 million. A good portion of it, I believe over $130 million of it, in direct bonuses they took or loans, essentially forgiven. Mm-hmm. This is essentially a case about if these two CEOs had the right to, or the CEO and the chief financial officer had the right to take loans as they wished, as relocation
right.
loans, and that's what it came down to in the end. I mean, it's turned into a case about sort of criminal intent. Did these people intend to deceive? Did these people intend to loot the company? Or they just believed that, honestly, this was what they were doing is fine.
So $130 million in bonuses and loans, another $400 or so million plus million in options payout.
Right. or actually in selling their stock.
Right.
And after saying to investors that we were tightening our belts. So that could be construed as securities fraud, misleading the investors.
And how has the prosecution gone? Are they being applauded for the job they've done, or not?
Well,
I know that they're always armchair, referees in these things.
Well, certainly. I mean, this conventional knowledge. What they did is they took a bunch of evidence and threw it against a wall, hoping some of it would stick. And that's their approach. It's been, thirty witnesses on the stand. You know, that's a lot. And so, 15,000 pages of transcripts. You know, it's amazing case they put on. In terms of sheer length. And a lot of the armchair quarterbacks are saying that maybe next time, if there was a mistrial, they would learn from this and make it a shorter, more tailored case, somewhat like the Martha Stewart trial ended up being.
Mr. Kozlowski's primary lawyer, Stephen Kaufman, trying to say to the jury last week that, all of this fancy partying wasn't necessarily relevant, quoting Abraham Lincoln, saying, "It's been my experience that folks who have no vices have very few virtues." What's the heart of the defense been?
The heart of the defense been is it comes back to this in criminal intent. They thought that what they were doing was appropriate in terms of what the company allowed them to do with these relocation loans and the spirit of what the Board of Trustees had suggested. And, you know, don't judge us because we have, you know, extravagant taste. Judge us because we weren't criminals is essentially what their defense has been. And Kozlowski did not put on any defense, really, in terms of he had called no witnesses. Mr. Schwartz went on the stand himself and basically said that, yes, we believe that we had knowledge. The board was all with us, and we weren't acting any way criminally.
Now, earlier this month, Judge Obus struck down the most serious charge against these two: enterprise corruption. What was that? Why was it thrown out?
It was thrown out because that was considered the more sort of, I guess, way to put it would be far-fetched part of the trial, and ended up sticking to the core bits, which really take us down single-handed, just by the point. Stealing from the company, falsifying business documents, and lying to investors.
Now, maybe the jury's back on track. Maybe they're not. We'll have to see. If it should ever come to a mistrial, what does that mean for Kozlowski and Schwartz? Are they off, or do they get tried again? What happens?
Well, most likely they'll get tried again, and another long trial ahead. Certainly, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, who's prosecuting the case, has mentioned that they will definitely re-prosecute. And who knows? Maybe they might not want to sit through another 6-month trial, and maybe they'll take a plea deal. Who knows?
A plea deal, but they've fought this long and hard already. And as you say, today the jury seemed more calm, but it was only a few days ago that they were talking about irreparable problems there. What's the reading? Is there any expectation of when a verdict might come down?
Covering trials, I've learned, try to never speculate on that because you're always wrong. we'd hope this week, if they keep this pace, perhaps we'll have one in the next couple of days. But I'm not betting on it.
Well, a lot of big trials coming up and going on with WorldCom, Adelphia Enron, and here with Tycho Barney Gimbel. Thanks for your coverage. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Barney Gimbel is a special correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from New York.
Okay, then just remember that this has to be 12-0 either way. That's the law. Now, all those voting guilty, please raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay, that's 11 guilty. Those voting not guilty, 1. Right. 11 guilty, 1 not guilty. Well, now we know where we are.
Boy, oh boy, there's always one.
There, a scene from the 1957 classic 12 Angry Men. This time around, the one holdout in the Tycho case has raised howls and mystery with her alleged OK signal to the defense team. Tonight on Point, inside the Tycho trial, what do you make of the sound and fury coming out of the Tycho deliberations? When you hear a juror is holding out, do you presume they are holding out for justice or with some other agenda? And is the work of juries today getting altogether too public? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is one of the top defense attorneys in the country, Ivan Fisher. He specializes in federal criminal litigation. Good evening and welcome, Ivan Fisher.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for joining us. Also with us tonight, Mark Zauderer, a partner at the law firm Piper Rudnick and chairman of New York's Commission on the Jury, a blue-ribbon panel of judges and lawyers that monitors the jury system. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Zauderer.
Hi there.
Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We want to hear from both of you what you've made of this incredible kind of outburst in the last few days with the Tyco trial. Ivan Fisher, to you first. As you saw this thing kind of explode and seem for a while to unravel at the end of last week and over the weekend, how are you reading? What was going on here?
Well, I'm reading the notes, and I think there's been a great misconception about where the jury was at last Thursday late afternoon. The notion that has abounded is that the jury is polarized, 11-1 for conviction, and the lone holdout is for acquittal. But the fact is, the note that was sent at 4 o'clock completely made clear that there was a rambunctious, diffident, discordant juror, but that the rest of the jury felt it could proceed with rational, calm deliberations to a just verdict, and the rest of the jury was itself not at all unanimous about guilt or innocence. It specifically said that.
So what you're picturing is simply one juror who is somehow so disruptive that the others can't even deliberate to a conclusion?
That's what they were telling the judge.
That's a pretty wild picture to imagine. Mark Zauderer, you've looked a lot at juries. Is it possible for one juror to make it impossible for the rest of a jury to work through a case?
Well, that's certainly possible, but I'll tell you the way I look at this right now. You know, a jury is very much like a family. You know, a family can get along or it can be dysfunctional. And you've got essentially strangers thrown together for a very, very long time.
A long time, 6 months nearly.
Yeah, 6 months. And now they're put to the hard task of debating. And just as family members one day can say, look, you know, I'm leaving the house, or I'm not, you know, we're finished, we can't discuss this anymore. You know, a good night's sleep can sometimes put a new cast on things. And judges have experience with this, with juries. This is not an uncommon phenomenon. And it's the judge's job here to strike a balance between ensuring that the jurors don't give up, that the communication stays open on the one hand, and on the other hand, being sure that they're not unduly coercive with a juror who perhaps out of conscience is sticking to his or her point of view. And I think what happened today indicates that the judge really has his hand firmly on the throttle. And I think he made the chance of a mistrial unlikely here. In the event there's a conviction, as he's required to do under the law, he interviewed privately with the lawyers present the apparent holdout at this point to determine if she felt that she could continue to deliberate. You know, and this woman, as she's demonstrated, is no shrinking violet. And if the judge was persuaded, presumably based on what she said, that she could continue to deliberate, it's hard to see how a case could be made that she's being unduly coerced, notwithstanding all the publicity, because she could have really communicated that to the judge.
When you brought him into chambers there. There's a lot we want to understand tonight about jury dynamics, jury selection, how juries work as they sit through a case and come to their final deliberations. Ivan Fisher, though, give us the basics here. Does this jury have to come up with a unanimous decision?
Yes. Everyone must agree on the result, count by count.
And all it takes is one holdout, could be this one, for a hung jury, and then what happens?
Well, in the event of a hung jury, a mistrial is declared, and then the process begins anew, but with some major and distinct differences. You've got defendants who are, unlike most defendants, in a position to mount a very substantial re-defense, a retrial of this case. They have the financial resources to do this. Most defendants can not afford a six-month trial in the first place, much less two of them. And he'll be in the driver's seat, in a sense, because he has this complete script of the prosecution's case, and they have all of the testimony of the prosecution's witnesses down, and they can use the months that they'll seek and get before a retrial to investigate the slightest shreds of misstatements made by the witnesses in this trial and use that evidence against the witnesses at the next trial.
So if it hangs, it could be to the benefit of Dennis Kozlowski and Mark Swartz here. We're looking tonight at the Tyco trial and cries of a runaway jury or juror. What is going on here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do you make of the sound and fury coming out of the Tyco trial? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Tyco trial and cries of a runaway jury or juror and what's going on in there. My guest tonight from New York, Ivan Fisher, a New York defense attorney specializing in federal criminal litigation. Also from New York, Mark Zauderer, a partner at the law firm Piper Rudnick and chairman of New York's Commission on the Jury, a blue ribbon panel of judges and attorneys that monitors the jury system. You can join us tonight when you hear one jury is holding out. If that's what it is, do you presume he or she is holding out for justice or for some other agenda? What's your experience been in the jury room? Where are your sympathies in this standoff, if it is still a standoff? And when the jury says it's gotten poisonous, what do you think is going on in there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ivan Fisher, a lot of publicity around this case and this juror, this sketch on the front page of the New York Post, and some pretty mocking, inflammatory language there, calling her a baddie, blue blood, a holdout granny, saying she's from the Upper East Side, even after the Wall Street Journal did it online, publishing her name. How significant is all this surround outside of the courtroom, outside of the jury room, to the case itself?
It depends on the juror. She might very well feel obliged to stick to her guns, particularly on account of the public assault. On the other hand, she may feel intimidated or threatened by the public exposure of her lonely position.
And Mark Zauderer, what about this exposing of her very name and even the part of town she lives in? I don't know. For all I know, people could look her up in the phone book at this point.
Yes.
You've looked at the whole jury system. This is not supposed to happen, is it?
Well, it is uncommon for this to happen. It's not prohibited by law, and I think Ivan could confirm that. But this juror, by all accounts, is extremely independent. One has to assume that she took the stance she did, even if she did so, making the sign in the courtroom, was a pretty bold move, whether it's proper or not. It's hard to imagine that the publicity, much of which had already occurred, that publicity that's mounting after this would have a significant effect on her. And yes, you're right. Not only can she be looked up, but she has been looked up. According to press accounts today, somebody spoke with her doorman in the media, spoke to a neighbor, and commented on her personality.
Right.
So, yes, so that is absolutely occurring. It's unfortunate. I do think it's unfortunate because our system depends on people deliberating as free from prejudice and bias and pressure as possible. We do our best in the voir dire process that we're all familiar with to weed out biased and prejudiced jurors. You can't always determine whether somebody is going to be influenced by this kind of thing, and most people would be very susceptible to pressure, unconscious if not conscious. So from the perspective of the justice system and from the juror's perspective, it is not a good thing to have this kind of exposure and revelation of a juror's name.
Ivan Fisher, what do you make of the role the media has played here? New York Post today, very critical, quoting an alternate juror who had also been on the panel, who had sat in the jury room, calling her a braggart. She's a teacher, a law degree. Quoting him saying, it's always just me, 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 that is, with her. People really didn't like her. Should the New York Post be doing this?
Well, from the press perspective, I suppose so. But from the point of view of the process of deliberations, definitely not. If the press were to step back and take a conscientious look at the best interests of the process, it wouldn't do this because, as Mark just said, the system depends upon the rational deliberative process amongst these 12 people. And privacy and secrecy and confidentiality are very, very important dynamics of that process. We have rules that prohibit jurors from prejudicing their own verdicts by their subsequent testimony. It can't be done. And that's because we want the sanctity of the privacy of these deliberations to remain intact. And here we have a newspaper crashing through the, in effect, barrier that has typically existed between the public and the jury's deliberations. If, in fact, this jury winds up hung, everyone in New York is going to believe they know for sure that it's she who did it. And a six-month trial will have gone down the tubes, and she is responsible, at least in the public belief.
We heard from Barney Gimbel earlier that there's some dispute about whether this OK sign, the hand sign OK, against her forehead out of the judge's sight was actually given. But the report was a big smile and OK sign for Dennis Kozlowski. If that happened, Ivan Fischer, how do you read that? Should that in itself mean the end of this trial?
Not at all. I have the experience myself of summing up some years ago in front of a jury after a long trial, a 3 or 4 month trial. And during my summation, a juror gave me the OK sign emphatically. There was no question that it was an emphatic OK sign. And I finished my summation believing with great confidence that at the worst, I would have a hung jury.
It was in the bag for you there, yeah.
Absolutely in the bag. And the jury convicted my client. And I spoke to the juror afterwards and the other jurors, too, and he led the charge for conviction. So when I asked him what this OK sign was about, he said, "I just wanted you to know I really respected how well you were doing."
Nice job, but he's going nice down job. Anyway.
Can I make a comment on
Mark
that?
Mark Zatter, please.
Yeah, I agree with Ivan. And what's important to remember here is that the issue is whether the juror has engaged in misconduct, which would prejudice the trial, prejudice the process. And here you have a situation which is uncommon. Most of these situations arise when somebody tries to communicate to the juror, where the juror has received some information in which it's contended that it will infect the deliberative process. Mm-hmm. Here you have exactly the opposite. You have the juror making a sign to somebody else, and it's hard to see how that could infect the process. So the traditional circumstance has not arisen here, which leads to a disqualification of a juror for misconduct.
I guess it's just the opposite way around. Take us into the dynamics here. We'll get to the jury room, but first, just in the selection, if indeed juror number 4 is as difficult a personality as she's been presented, and we don't know for sure, but if that's true, how do you think, Ivan Fischer, she ended up on the jury? Was the prosecution asleep at the switch when it screened her as a juror?
Very much so. This is a woman who apparently decided to go to law school at age 55. She graduated at age 58. She's a patrician. The prosecution would have had on one of the juror cards her address and known that she came from a very good neighborhood in Manhattan, and would have seen that this is a very independent type person, and one who might very well result in a hung jury.
Might sympathize with Kozlowski and Schwartz, the big money guys.
Absolutely.
Mark Zatter, do you agree? If you had been in the prosecution, do you think you would have spotted, could have spotted her and screened her out?
One would hope so. And there are two things here that I think are interesting. One, as you may know or may not, that lawyers were disqualified, or rather were exempted from service, as were doctors and undertakers, until the mid-1990s.
Okay.
Since we've removed exemptions by profession, we now have lawyers serving on juries. They are serving, but some will strike them on the voir dire process, on both the prosecution and defense side, on the very ground that they're likely to take over and dominate the deliberations.
Is there a pattern of that happening? Have you seen it?
There is perceived by some a pattern of that happening. But your question is, how did they stay on? Why weren't they stricken? It's hard to understand, because in New York, there are more peremptories allowed, that is, strikes that either the prosecution or the defense can make for any reason at all, than in any other state in the country. And in the most serious criminal cases, there are 20 per side and 15 in crimes that are of somewhat less severity. And to think that this woman somehow fell between the cracks in the perception of the of the prosecution. You know, I don't like the second-guess strategy at a trial, but it's a bit surprising.
Well, something severe was going on last week. Maybe it's been ironed out this week, and maybe it hasn't. Ivan Fisher, Mark Zatter, are standby. A lot of callers want to join us. I'd like to turn to them. Steve is calling from Plymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. One thing quickly, and that is I'm surprised neither of your guests has used the term, which I think was current a few years ago, of nullifying. It has an ironic twist. It was used in, I used to live in Washington, D.C., in particularly African-American communities and juries who, as it were, just would not send another, you know, another black man or another ethnic group they happen to come from to prison.
Right.
And I think the term being used was to nullify. Anyway, what I wanted to say is I was on a jury on a police brutality case in Washington a couple of years ago, and I just wanted to tell you the poignant lesson of my experience there was how incredibly important the first formation of a majority is in the deliberations. Because once, in our case, nine-member jury, once that fifth vote was cast, there were a number of, frankly, fairly weak-willed jurors who sided with the rest of the majority, not because they agreed with them on the facts or the law, but because they were tired and didn't want to go on.
A lot of months, a lot of weeks, a lot of days and hours in that room, and they cast a lot with the majority that first emerged.
And so I guess the point is, while I think some of the behavior of this particular juror we're hearing about does sound, at the very least, odd, we shouldn't presume that, in fact, she is the only juror who is in favor of acquittal. There may be some, if you will, latent acquitters in there who just aren't prepared to go on and take on the majority.
Steve, we've got it, and thanks for your call. Ivan Fisher, that was pretty much your point at the top of this conversation. Let's not assume she's the lone holdout. Let's not assume that everybody else is ready to go in one direction or another.
I think there may be overt people for acquittal in the jury deliberating now. And the process, which has recommenced deliberation, at least based on the notes sent out today, indicate that they're back to work in a more dispassionate way. The judge was very shrewd in, although he seemed to be leaning heavily towards granting a mistrial on Friday, he stepped back from that and decided that it was best to send the jury home Friday early for a long weekend and give passions the time to subside. And hopefully they would be back to deliberate. I think if the jury sent out another note like the notes Thursday night, he would have granted a mistrial in a heartbeat.
Well, let's take care of this language issue for a minute. Nullify. Is that the same as a mistrial? Is that different? Hung jury, nullify, mistrial, all the same or different birds?
No, well, nullify is to disregard the law and impose a verdict in, not consistent with the law. So, for example, if, in fact, you disagree with the law under which someone is being charged, you vote to acquit, even though it's clear they're guilty of the charge, you don't like the law, so you nullify the effect of the law. It's not a mistrial. It's an acquittal.
And that's legal, and the judge would say, okay, this is what's happened, and that's the way it goes.
No, it's not legal, and jurors are not supposed to do it, and juries are not supposed to do it.
I see.
It sometimes happens.
And then the judge turns around and nullifies the jury? Is that the right language? I don't have the semantics here.
No, it's not the right language, but the judge has no authority to set aside an acquittal by a jury, none whatsoever. The acquittal stands forever.
Mark Zatter, how about this notion that there's still a real active debate going on in here, that it may even be leaning toward acquittal? Can you picture that from what you followed of this trial?
I frankly find that hard to imagine in this case. You know, this is a case that was a powerful one. The evidence was extremely strong. And while it's true that all the jurors but that one may want to go through the different counts and evaluate the evidence, it's hard to imagine that there is a serious number of people there for acquittal on all counts, and everything we're getting by way of the notes, to the extent we can connect the dots, supports that in my mind. I think the probability that this case could come out with an acquittal is next to zero.
Ivan Fisher, then paint a picture of how last week the jury would have saying that their ability to deliberate was irreparably compromised. What sort of interpersonal or jury dynamic could have created that note?
Severe antagonism of a very personal nature, the trading back and forth of ad hominem insults as I said, on a very personal mm-hmm. basis, calling each other names, serious names, hard names, anger, a great deal of anger.
Well, if that's what it was, it doesn't sound pretty. Tom is calling from Stoneham, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I just want to make one point, and then I'll just listen to your response.
Sure.
I think that, you know, I sort of like to take a big picture look at this, and I think our jury system and our judicial system in general is just, it's really a wonderful thing. You know, if I were being tried for something, I don't think there's any other country on earth where I'd rather be tried, because I think that the integrity and the rationality of our system is really exemplary. So, you know, I think that if we have a case here where a crook gets off, you know, where one or two crooks get off because of a problem with the jury, that's not nearly as bad as if we somehow tried to tamper with the system and change it, because that would change the jury system for everyone. So, you know, I think we just have to sort of suck it up and let the process do what it's doing. And so I'll take your responses off.
You got it, got it loud and clear, Tom. Thanks for your call. I have to say my own experience with jury has been kind of magical, the seriousness in that jury room that turned 12 people into very solid citizens for the time of their consideration. Mark Zotter, in general, you've been looking at this through the New York Commission on the Jury. Mm-hmm. What's your sense of how well juries are doing in our media-soaked culture, in a time when citizenship may not be the first thing on everyone's mind? Is the jury system, Mark says, Tom says, let's take a big picture look.
Yep.
Is it working?
Yes, you've really hit the nail on the head there. The evidence is overwhelming that citizens who actually get to serve on a jury and hear a case respond positively to the experience. They rise to the occasion and feel it as a very important event in their life. The dissatisfaction that we see in the system stems in large part from the fact that in the processing, so to speak, of jurors from the time they're called to the time they're discharged in the system, most of them don't actually get to serve on a case. In New York, we found it's in the area of 80%. Now, some of that's for legitimate reason. They can't serve for one reason or another. But the fact is that their experience, as reported to us, is very different from those who actually get to hear a trial. And people who do that find it to be, by and large, a superb experience.
Well, but maybe not this time, unless they manage to turn it around even after it hit bottom there. And Ivan Fisher, just got to get one more angle from you on how you think this might be leaning toward acquittal. All this evidence of flamboyant spending, the big numbers, the air full of charges against WorldCom and Adelphia and Enron and Martha Stewart. In spite of all that, you think there just could be a jury in there thinking, oh, Kozlowski should go free?
I think there are some jurors who have that notion. The process began with a note or two seeking clarification from the court about criminal intent and wanting to know if whether or not a defendant actually believed that what he was doing was legitimate. Even if it wasn't, would that entitle him to an acquittal? And the judge instructed the jury they would have to acquit such a person. And I recall that the view outside of the jury when that note or notes came out was that they were extremely positive indicators for the defense. Now, in retrospect, it might have been a note generated by juror number four.
Maybe that's just what it was. Ivan Fisher, itself. Stand by. Mark Zotter, we've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the Tyco trial and cries of a runaway jury. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Tyco trial and the cries of runaway jury or juror. What do you think's going on here? You can join our conversation tonight. What do you make of the sound and fury coming out of the Tyco trial? Are juries and jurors just getting too public? Should they do their job and go home or go straight to Oprah? What's your vote in this case? Hang them high or debate a while longer. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What's your experience been with jury duty? We're joined tonight from New York by Ivan Fisher, a New York defense attorney, and by Mark Zotter, a partner at Piper Rudnick, chairman of New York's Commission on the Jury. Mark, Mike is calling right now. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom.
Evening.
I was on a jury 10 years ago in Southern California, and my experience there was not in contrast to what your guest had said previously. I think a number of people had taken on the jury had taken their duty seriously, but I was surprised at how emotional and what an emotional basis the decisions were the jurors used in making their decisions, in particular their reactions to the lawyers as well as the defendant. And I wanted to know if there are any studies out there to give some light on this matter.
Emotional as opposed to rational or considered or informed.
Yes, I mean, in my experience, I mean, what I was the holdout juror, not because I particularly empathize with the defendant, but I, you know, in a lot of cases, there are some significant gray areas, and I wanted to just have some dialogue on the gray areas, and I found that a lot of the jurors were not particularly interested in that they had made their minds up pretty early on.
Yep, and emotion you saw as the basis for them doing that. Mike, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Ivan Fisher, how about it? A lot to excite the emotions in this trial. All these descriptions of wild partying and high living, the famous 40th birthday party in Sardinia for Dennis Kozlowski's wife, where the ice sculpture of Michelangelo's David had vodka flowing from its penis. This could get people upset emotionally with this guy, whatever they thought of the details.
And that was the intention of the prosecution, to spoil Kozlowski's chances at a dispassionate rendering of a verdict. And we'll see whether or not it succeeds. But particularly in a long trial, jurors get to analyze things much more carefully and clearly. Apparently this one was thinking about the case throughout the length of the trial, perhaps even talking to each other about it in violation of the judge's orders, but doing it nonetheless. And there is a great deal of emotional content in this case, lascivious spending, as you've described, that could be generated. But given a long trial, there is time for that to you get accustomed to it. After a while, perhaps you're even numb to it, given the enormous amount of evidence the prosecution put in about it. And after a while, it loses its effect.
Mark Sutter, I wonder, as I watched this case just a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the Martha Stewart case. You'll remember jurors who spoke after that verdict came down, one in particular who we had tape of on the show, who talked about doing the right thing and, as I recall, striking a blow for the little guy. There is a kind of let's clean up this town mood at large after all the apparent corporate corruption of the late 1990s. How much, our caller asks about emotion, how much does that kind of broader public mood flow into a jury room and into deliberation in a particular trial?
Well, I think based on recent experience, it's not happening. I mean, when you saw the Martha Stewart jurors interviewed, and we got to see most of them, they seemed to make a pretty rational, sound decision. Indeed, the concern was the opposite by some watchers, that they would, as someone spoke about before, nullify the government's case here, that even though they might find the evidence compelling, they would be so sympathetic to her because she's a public figure as to whom they might feel the government was overreaching, that they would exonerate. So I don't see any evidence there. Another example, that was the Quattrone case, if you remember, where there was a hung jury.
Right.
There was, you know, if there had been operating there a great sense of outrage in the community that had filtered through to the jury, I think you would have seen a stronger movement towards conviction there in that case. So I don't think there's any evidence that the wave of outrage against corporate crime is affecting jury verdicts in these public cases, at least so far.
Not a mob effect that you can see. Alan is calling. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hey, good evening. Good evening. Just got my notification for jury service in Massachusetts.
Congratulations, citizen.
Well, thank you. But my concern is, if all of a sudden, by my serving on a jury, I'm going to be nailed in public by a newspaper, pointed out, and other kinds of made public, why would I ever want to serve on a jury?
Stick with us, Alan. Mark Zutter, how do you respond to that?
I think that's a superb point. It really is goes to the heart of what the jury system is about. It's the ability to render a fair and impartial judgment to the best of one's ability. And here's an example of a citizen who's calling in, who is I think, terrified may be too strong a word, but is certainly very anxious about that prospect. And if he's expressed that, you can imagine that there are thousands of others who would feel the same way.
Yeah, so I think I have no desire to have my name, my address, my phone number publicized simply because I'm sitting on a jury of 6 or 12 people.
Well, you have a fair point there, and I think that perhaps this trial, when all the dust is settled, may bring into focus this issue. You know, law changes, and law is made as the result of experience. And depending on what happens in an individual case, and sometimes in a high-profile case, you know, the rules that courts apply to these things change. And who knows, you know, after this case, it may be that we see some appeals court decisions that change the rules on this and say that you should not reveal the juror's name unless there's some compelling reason to do so. They kind of would flip it around from the current standard. You know, the federal court, and Ivan can speak to this too, in the Martha Stewart case, where the judge closed off some of the matters that were occurring with the jury from the press, the Court of Appeals said that she had made a mistake. Unless there was some compelling reason to do so, this should all be open. Well, you know, this may cause the pendulum to swing back on this issue the other way.
Alan, thanks for your call. Ivan Fisher, what do you think about that? Do citizens risk becoming that guy in Wrigley Field in the World Series last year whose hand allegedly hit the ball, you know, exposed for all to ridicule after a trial if they end up standing against a majority?
Well, in this case, something very unusual occurred or was thought to have occurred. That is the high sign signal. Were it not for the high sign signal, juror number 4 would not have been singled out or exposed.
So in a way, she brought it on herself, you're saying, by that public
display.
That is
correct.
Gosh, I guess the lesson there is vote however you want to vote, but keep it to yourself.
Yes.
Mark, do juries, by and large, keep their votes private? Do they expose who voted how when they come out of the jury room?
There's a great variation in that approach. And what good judges do is to tell the jurors at the conclusion of the case that they are free to talk or not talk with the lawyers and the press. Lawyers, of course, always want to talk to the jurors because they want to know how they did and to fine-tune their presentations for the next time.
Mm-hmm.
But jurors should be told, as they usually are, that they need not talk with the press. It's purely voluntary, and they shouldn't feel compelled to do so.
Ivan Fisher, last issue for you, and it's back to the Tyco case itself. Can you imagine that these guys, chairman and chief financial officer in this giant corporation, billions flying everywhere, would have not understood the law? Could there not be criminal intent after all that big spending, all that money over the dam?
Absolutely. Their position is that everything they did, every dime that they spent, had been authorized formally or informally by the board. The board is, in fact, the corporation. That's how the corporation functions. The corporation is the board. The board is the corporation. You can't steal from someone who gives you the money, and that's their position.
Even though you've got 6 board members, as I recall, saying, oh, no, we didn't sign off on all that.
Revisionist. As Mr. Kaufman argued to the jury in summation, these are people who, with the benefit of hindsight and under the public glare and scrutiny, have decided that, in fact, they perhaps did not authorize what, in reality, they had authorized.
So maybe there wasn't even a sense of criminal intent. Things were flying pretty loose there, if that was the case. We will be watching this case closely and the jury to see what kind of verdict comes down. We thank both of you so much for illuminating this tonight. Ivan Fisher, New York, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Ivan Fisher, a New York defense attorney, and Mark Zauder, also partner at Piper Rudnick, chairman of New York's Commission on the Jury. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a victory for opponents of gay marriage. This is On Point. Another major development in the national debate over gay marriage today, this time in Massachusetts, where last November the state's Supreme Court ruled same-sex couples were entitled to marry. Tonight, by a vote of 105-92, Massachusetts lawmakers voted to approve a constitutional amendment that would ban gay marriage while establishing civil unions. The proposal now moves to the next legislative session, and if it passes then, it will be put onto the 2006 ballot for voters to decide. The battle over gay marriage is being fought right across the country. Marriage licenses have been issued to same-sex couples in many states, including Oregon, New Mexico, New York, and California. 3,400 gay couples have been married in San Francisco alone. WBUR's Fred Tyus has been covering the gay marriage debate and joins me now in the studio. Fred, what exactly has happened this evening in Massachusetts?
You've summed it up very well. The state has now taken one step closer to banning gay marriage. This constitutional amendment passed by the legislature tonight would ban gay marriage, at the same time establish civil unions with all the rights of marriage, with a caveat that none of the federal rights of marriage would apply,
rights that the state could extend.
Exactly, only the ones that the state could extend.
Now, there's another step in the legislature, but as this essentially put it, will it essentially go on the ballot even now after this vote today, or could it still be hung up in its final pass through the legislature?
It could absolutely be hung up in its final path through the legislature. There's an election between now and then. There'll be a different makeup in the legislature.
So when will it go before the legislature next?
Next year.
Next year, a full year of contemplation and fulmination and voting and everything else.
That's right. That's right.
In the meantime, beginning very soon, these gay marriages will be legal in Massachusetts under the ruling of the High Court in the state last fall. The voters won't know for a while yet whether they'll have a chance to amend the Constitution. What happens with these marriages that are certainly going to go through in the interim, or I presume will go through in the interim?
Well, that's a big question right now. Yes, as of May 17th, the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts has said that the state may no longer prevent same-sex couples from getting married. Governor Romney, the Republican governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, today said that he would ask the state's highest court to stay its decision until the voters have a chance to vote on this in 2006. Were he to succeed in that, it would be very unlikely for him to succeed in that because he'd have to demonstrate that the state would be injured in some way by having this happen
marriages
right now.
Go ahead.
As opposed to gay couples, of course, would argue they'd be even more injured by waiting that long. And he must do it through the state's attorney general, the Democratic attorney general, Tom Riley, who tonight said that he would not ask the state's highest court for such a stay.
So he wouldn't be cooperative, and there's no guarantee that they would give that stay in any case. But for tonight, a step closer to a constitutional ban in Massachusetts on gay marriage, a long way to go yet. What were the advocates here saying, the supporters of same-sex marriage, the opponents? What was the noise outside? There's been a lot of attention to this locally and nationally.
Well, both sides seem to feel a defeat tonight. The opponents of gay marriage wanted just a plain old ban on gay marriage. They did not want civil unions put into the Constitution, which is what would happen if this amendment gets passed. And, of course, the supporters of same-sex marriage also felt a big, big disappointment today because as of May 17th, without this amendment, they would normally have gay marriage. And you raise that question about what's going to happen to those people who get married between May 17th and 2006 should the voters of Massachusetts ban gay marriage. And that's that. There's a lot of argument on both sides, but advocates of same-sex marriage say likely that they would not have their rights taken away because the federal Constitution specifically bans the rescission of contracts.
So, in other words, if they're married after May 17th, if they're married before a constitutional amendment, no matter what happens there might be a couple of years of window where people just got married and those marriages stood, those same-sex marriages.
Exactly. And even if the voters take that away in 2006, they're likely to challenge the gay couples are likely to challenge that in federal court because the federal Constitution protects contracts.
Talk about an interesting historical anomaly if it should go there. That way. Fred Tyus, thanks for your coverage and thanks for being with us tonight.
You're welcome, Tom.
WBUR reporter Fred Tyus. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.